Hello and welcome to the next in our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2024, all of which are themed around the topic of equine well-being. Today we're talking about disease prevention and protection, and to discuss this topic I'm joined by two world-leading equine vets from our Equine Infectious Disease Advisory Group. First up is Celia Maher, who is a specialist in internal medicine and has been a part of the team at Rossdale's Equine Hospital and Diagnostic Centre since 2003. Welcome, Celia.
Thank you.
And joining her is Richard Newton, who is the Director of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance for the Equine Infectious Disease Surveillance Group, which is based at Cambridge Veterinary School. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Rachel.
So I think probably the first place to start then is what are actually some of the common infectious diseases that pose a risk to the UK horse population? Richard, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll kick things off, and I'm sure Celia's got her own view on what's important. But in terms of sheer numbers of diseases being diagnosed in UK horses, strangles is the top of the list. That's a bacterial disease caused by a streptococcus bacteria called Streptococcus equi. And we make several hundred diagnoses are made by the laboratories. There's probably many more cases than that occurring in the UK. There is a related bacteria called Streptococcus zooepidemicus, and that accounts for some disease that particularly young horses get, but can also affect the fertility in mares. One that was quite notable back in 2019, which I'm sure many people are aware of and through the need to vaccinate, is equine influenza. That's a viral disease. That stayed with us since 2019. And we're making probably between 20 and 30 diagnoses every year of that disease. And that can come in from overseas with imported horses and cause local problems, particularly where animals are not vaccinated. A recurring problem which we have every year is caused by equine herpes virus. And there are nine different types of that virus, the one that really causes problems is EHV1, and that can cause respiratory disease, although the main problems are in that it causes abortion and death of newborn foals. And most importantly, it can cause outbreaks of neurological disease. And we saw that with a large outbreak in southern Spain back in 2021. So those are the sort of three main types, bacterial disease and two viral diseases that cause the major problems. But I'm sure there are many other diseases, Celia, in foals, for example, that you deal with.
Yeah, exactly. So you've kind of, I mean, it is just all about your background. You've given the epidemiology answer, which is really about outbreaks and prevalence, and which is the most prevalence. If you look at it from a kind of clinical perspective, I guess my answer really reflects my own sort of location. I'm based in a hospital, so the things that actually come into the hospital, in other words, things that make horses really ill, I would definitely put GI infections up there. So obviously we have our very young foals, which are susceptible to diarrhea. Notable causes there are rotavirus, and then also just septicemia. And in the slightly older horse, actually, parasites are probably far more more impactful than people realize. Everyone knows that horses get worms, and for the mature adult, that actually is something that it may cause some level of medical problems, but not really life-threatening medical problems. But in the younger age group, up to about 2 years of age, then we're seeing increasingly problems with sathistomyces or small redworm. So I'd put that one on the list. And then, because even just looking at the diseases that you've mentioned, strangles, you know, the facts are that strangles is the most commonly diagnosed thing. But for the majority of horses, not all of the horses, but the majority of the illness is relatively mild. Whereas tetanus, which is pretty uncommon, the thing is, if your horse does get tetanus, it's unfortunately very unlikely to survive. So you know, there is quite a long list. And actually, Richard, I'm interested that you didn't mention the exotic diseases. What do you think about them in terms of posing risk to the UK population?
Yeah, I agree. I think they are a threat, and I'm sure we'll come on to discuss those in more detail. But we are, thankfully, at the moment, we're not seeing much of that. But it's definitely a risk, and those different diseases come in different forms. No doubt we'll talk about West Nile virus. This is a disease that causes neurological disease. It's transmitted by mosquitoes. The virus is harbored in birds, and it's getting closer. We're seeing it in northern Germany now. We're seeing it in mainland Europe. And we've been worried about it for quite a while. And there are other diseases as well. Equine infectious anemia occasionally crops up. That's an interesting disease because it can lay almost sort of clinically silent. We have chronic carriage of the virus. And if we're not looking for it and detecting it in imported animals, then it can crop up and cause problems. So, yeah, the exotics are there, and we have to be on our radar in terms of surveillance. But I think what you saw there in those answers was an interesting contrast, and that's why I think, you know, hopefully Celia and I complement each other in this: what's out there in the general population, and then what might pose a risk for animals getting referred into hospitals. And they're not all necessarily the same thing, and the diseases that I talked about, there wouldn't necessarily be many of those getting referred into equine hospitals, and when they do, they cause particular headaches and concerns for the likes of experts like Celia. And she's grinning, and she knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, obviously in the hospital, we're very fortunate here that we have a nice unit to be able to deal with horses that potentially have infectious disease, but certainly it is challenging. We have to have higher levels of biosecurity. Everything just takes more effort, but that's why the hospitals are here. You know, we're willing and ready to receive these horses, but we clearly have to think very carefully about where they're going to be housed, extra levels of biosecurity, how we're going to deal with their bedding and all the potential that the disease could spill out beyond that one horse.
Well, that's us sort of suitably scared about the variety of things out there that could affect our horses. But what are some of the common signs and symptoms that owners might spot that indicate their horse has become victim to a disease?
Well, I'll pick this one up. So the single most important clinical sign that is kind of common to many infections, viruses, parasites, bacteria, fungus, whatever you think, is fever, actually. And, you know, people, if you haven't got a thermometer, then you should probably invest in one. So that's, I think, taking a horse's temperature is the single most important thing people can learn to do. That would apply to both the kind of outbreak type situation, the diseases that Richard mentioned, flu, strangles, herpes. Often the earliest clinical sign is an increase in temperature, and it's actually really quite useful if you kind of know your horse's normal temperature, because if you ask 10 vets, you might get slightly different answers to what constitutes a fever. But I would say that certainly 39 degrees is a definite fever, and between that zone of 38.3 and 39, it certainly should be an amber warning flag, if not a red warning flag. So, but if you know your horse's normal temperature, particularly if you're in a situation where you know let's say you know that there is some infection going around the group of horses that your horse has contact with, by monitoring its temperature, even an increase in baseline temperature, which doesn't actually hit the threshold of having a fever, but that slight increase in temperature could be an early warning sign. So yeah, fever, that's the number one. And then I think it kind of is going to depend on which particular infection we're talking about. So influenza, strangles, herpes, as Richard's mentioned, they really involve the respiratory tract. So we might expect to see things like nasal discharge, coughing, sometimes enlargement of the lymph nodes around the throat. And of course, with strangles, that's how it got its name. So the horses with strangles can really have quite large abscesses forming around their throat, to the point that it can make it difficult for them to swallow, it can make it difficult for them to breathe. And eventually those abscesses may actually burst and you'll have discharge from the abscesses. But that's a little bit further down the line. And then some of the other diseases that I mentioned, rotavirus in foals or indeed cystomyces, then those would tend to be more gastrointestinal signs. So it might be colic, it might be abdominal distension, or it might be diarrhea. And then I think the third group of clinical signs that makes me think that infection must be ruled out are neurological signs. And the neurological system obviously controls movement. So you might see that your horse is walking strangely, it might seem weak. With equine herpes virus, sometimes the first clinical sign is the horse is unable to rise. So things that are changing the way that it's moving. Tetanus the same. There are quite a constellation of signs that we see with tetanus, but what people often notice first is a sort of strange gait. The horse seems very stiff and stilted. Now, actually, there are other more non-common, non-infectious causes of neurologic signs. So just because you have neurologic signs doesn't mean that you definitely have infectious disease, but it certainly means that infectious disease needs to be ruled out. So yeah, those would be the three big groups: respiratory signs, GI signs, particularly diarrhea, and neurologic signs, which often show up as something's gone wrong with the way the horse is moving.
I would just add, I totally agree with everything Celia said, and great that she highlighted the importance of the horse's temperature and that changing as possibly the first sign as part of its response to, in the same way that we may do as humans respond to an infection. The other thing I just wanted to draw attention to now is that there are some technologies coming around which in time I think will make this much better in terms of doing it more regularly, doing it across all the horses. You know, people need to be careful taking temperatures, but it can be done if you go about it and get the horse used to it. And I think it's good to regularly do that. Ideally, you'd be doing it twice a day, morning and night, because of these diurnal rhythms. But now there are chips, identification chips that can go in, and they've got a thermal element to them, which means that you can read the temperature from the horse by just scanning that chip. And there are some other technologies, particularly they're used, I think, when shipping horses long distances, these probes that go under the bottom of the tail, and then you can remotely access what they're telling you, so people can respond quickly to those things. And I think getting the early warning about the temperature is really important, because that's your chance to do something early, possibly before the horse becomes highly infectious. You can move it out of a group, isolate it away, and hopefully that would give you the chance of reducing the impact of any infection that animal might be incubating.
Yeah, I'd agree, Richard. I think these thermal chips are going to be a real game changer, actually, because it's just becomes, particularly if you're managing groups of horses, it's just much easier to go in and wave your phone at the chip, and you have a log of what the horse's temperature is doing, and that technology is moving really quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think Not many people will necessarily be dealing with racehorses, but I think that's come in now. So foals are getting those put in, and as the population changes, it'll just become routine. So I think, as you say, it's a game changer in time. And touching on the neurological disease that Celia mentioned, the neurological side, whilst we may have scared you in the first discussion, I think we need to be we need to sort of think that we are lucky in some ways and that we don't necessarily have the range of infectious causes of neurological disease that they have in other parts of the world. And I'm thinking particularly about the Americas, North America, where they will have a whole range of other viruses that can cause these diseases and cause major problems. And we see reports of those, you know, virtually every year now. Something going on in Argentina that's quite impactful, Western equine encephalitis, which is causing a big problem down there, hasn't been seen for several decades and now is kind of re-emerging. So we are lucky that we don't have all of these diseases, but you know, we need to be alert to the possibility that they may arrive.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say, of course, the signs that I outlined are not the only signs that could indicate infection. So, for example, abortion probably or stillbirth, one would be concerned that there might be infection there. So fundamentally, obviously, if you're in that situation, it's really important to just speak to your vet, perhaps arrange for some further testing. No, clearly, it's not going to help that particular foal, but it might be very important for the other horses on the property to know whether infection is involved with these sort of losses.
Yeah, and I think, well, that's probably a key thing for all of these diseases, really, is if people are looking at their horses and noticing that things are a little bit different, as you say, maybe that temperature's creeping up a bit, is to get on the phone with their vet, because a lot of the time is of the essence, of, as you've alluded to there, Richard, that, you know, these diseases can progress quite quickly. And the sooner you kind of, you nip it in the bud, you get the vet involved, the more likely it is that your horse is going to recover quickly and return to its normal self.
Yeah, absolutely. Speed can be everybody's friend if it's acted upon early. And you know, we see several examples every year where that advice is not heeded, and perhaps you're several cases down the line. And as Celia was saying, that could be several, you know, unfortunate, you know, mares that have aborted because they are transmitting an infection between them. And often if we're talking about equine herpes virus 1, that first case can be the source of quite a lot of virus, which wasn't necessarily there before she did lose the foal. And then you may be playing catch up, and following the HBLB international codes of practice is really important. I need to give that document a plug. It's quite an old document now in terms of when it first came in, but it's reviewed and updated every year. Diseases are added to it. The advice that's in there is updated depending on what the science is telling us. And herpes is one of the really key diseases that it looks to help the industry, those that are breeding horses, manage effectively. So that's a good go-to document that I would advise anybody to seek out and get more information, and particularly advice on how to manage problems when they occur.
Or indeed, you could have the Equi BioSafe app, which is also getting a little old now, but it's basically an app form which encompasses the HBLB codes for breeders, and also a related document which is for horses in race training. But you can have it on your phone, and every time the HBLB codes are updated, that app gets updated along with it.
Well, we'll make sure that both those assets are signposted on the website, on the Equine Health Week page, so people can follow those links if they're interested. Now, one of the key things we can do in this country to protect our horses from disease is vaccination. And it can be a contentious topic. There's a lot of discussion around it. Now, what is the current advice regarding vaccination for horses in the UK?
Richard, do you want to go first or shall I?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I think it's really important. To also have to think about their own horse's situation. There isn't a one size fits all for all horses and everything, you know, must go through that. But I think there are some more what the Americans tend to call core vaccines, and we don't tend to use that phrase, but it's, you know, it's something that's worth thinking about, where probably some of these vaccines are absolutely integral, whatever you are, in terms of activity and purpose. And top of the list has to be tetanus. Tetanus vaccines are essentially, they're based on the toxin that causes the problem being inactivated. You put that in, it stimulates the horse's immune system. Sounds very simple, relatively cheap, highly, highly effective if it's done properly according to, you know, the data sheet for that. And that involves vaccinating horses from an early age, doing them reasonably regularly and building that up over time. As with humans, you don't have to necessarily do it every year, but once you've got a few of those doses in, that animal will be, I think, highly protected from the disease. There are the odd exceptions where disease can occur in vaccinated horses. But that has to be, you know, any owner needs to check that their horse is properly vaccinated against tetanus. And if they've got any doubts, they should get it done. It's a horrible disease. It will kill the horse, and it's eminently preventable. So that's kind of the first line. Then we have to start to think about the epidemiology, which horses are at risk. How are these diseases transmitted? And then I think we would probably come to equine influenza. Equine influenza, as we saw in 2019, can be significant, and it can spread. You don't necessarily need direct contact between animals. And there's a reason why racing and other disciplines have, for quite a number of decades now, insisted and introduce this requirement for vaccination, any horses going to the events. And that's because it will spread rapidly, and it will curtail those events happening. And we see that across the world, not every year, but we do see it repeating on a cycle every few years. And therefore, there are rules for vaccination. Following 2019, a group of people looked at this, and we concluded that if you have horses moving between events and they are at risk of flu, that probably boosting those animals every 6 months or so is probably going to give them optimal protection. We have slightly tweaked the intervals between the first two vaccines, that's the primary course, then a third dose, because it's been shown for a long time that if you go in a little bit sooner with your third dose of vaccine, you can improve the protection at the population level. So there's that one. And then you need to think about whether herpes virus is relevant to your type of animal, and certainly it's advocated through the codes of practice in breeding mares, and so again, well worth vaccinating those to at least help manage EHV1 as a threat. And then we come down to other vaccines. We've got a relatively new strangles vaccine on the market that offers quite a number of advantages over previous versions of vaccine that we've had here. So again, that should be discussed with your vet. Is that a product that would help my horses? And then we come on to the Celia will touch on rotavirus, I'm sure, and other diseases for foals. But the last one I wanted to mention was equine viral arteritis. It's one of our exotic diseases. We've had a vaccine available for a long time to protect stallions, which can become infected. And the problem with them becoming infected is that some of them will harbour the virus for a long time. They'll shed it in their semen at covering, and they'll perpetuate the disease that way. And we can protect those animals through vaccination. And there are issues with that vaccine at the moment, but when it comes back on the market, people need to think about its use. And the last one I actually just want to mention is for this disease, West Nile virus, that we don't have in the UK at the moment. There is a number of vaccines available, highly effective. So if you're travelling horses to parts of the world where that is a problem, then it's well worth thinking about vaccinating those animals before they go and are potentially at risk of contracting the disease.
Yeah, so I think I would have nothing much to argue with about there in your answer, Richard. I'd really like to emphasise the tetanus thing. So it's important, I think, that people understand that you can never remove risk completely, but of course you can reduce it. And so in the case of tetanus, there is every single horse, no matter what it does in life, in the UK, is at risk for tetanus, because tetanus is caused by a spore-forming organism. It's in the ground, and horses are outside. They get little wounds and nicks and things like that. And unlike us, who live indoors and have clothes on, every single horse is exposed to tetanus. And the thing is, you will occasionally see clinical signs of tetanus in horses that have been vaccinated. But generally, if that is the case, the severity of the signs is much reduced. The chances of the horse actually surviving the disease are enhanced. But most horses in which I have seen tetanus, one, do not survive, and two, have not been vaccinated. And, you know, it's a simple, relatively inexpensive vaccine. There's just, to my mind, no reason at all why there should be any British horse that doesn't benefit from tetanus vaccine. And then again, as Richard outlined, the key thing with moving on to influenza, the key thing with influenza is its ability to spread without necessarily very close contact amongst horses. So I'll often hear people say, oh, I never take my horse anywhere, therefore I don't need to vaccinate against flu. Generally, when I'm hearing this, it's because they're in a hospital. So they do take them to the hospital. So even if you don't frequently compete, there are occasions where unexpectedly you may have to take your horse somewhere that it's going to encounter others. So I would advocate again that pretty much every horse should get equine influenza. And we know from the 2019 outbreak, we actually, if you compare the British experience to that of other parts of Europe, when this influenza was spreading across Europe, we had more cases than they did in countries who had have higher levels of vaccination. So it's important, I think. And of course, an owner can protect and control what their horse does, but you can't necessarily control what some other person on the same property or a nearby property might be doing. So even if you don't take your horse to competitions very often, there's almost no horse really that won't benefit from influenza. The Strangles vaccine, it's great that Richard's highlighting that, because I think again that's something that probably will be a game changer for the future. We the vaccine's been available for relatively short period of time, but we're certainly excited to see the impact that's going to have. If moving on to herpes, that's definitely important for broodmares, because it's protecting the foals that they are carrying. The vaccine will also reduce the likelihood that a horse might get clinical signs associated, respiratory signs associated with EHV1 and EHV4. So it's one that I would think about as something for horses that are being kept in groups, horses that are going mixing frequently, perhaps younger horses. Herpes virus vaccine is certainly sensible. Whereas if you have a horse that you largely keep at home and you maybe go hacking and it meet a few of your mates and so forth, it's probably questionable whether vaccinating those individual horses is really going to be beneficial. Just to expand on foals, so obviously the EHV vaccine protects unborn foals. The thing with newborn foals is that their immune system is not fully competent. So that means that they're not able to fight off infection, but it also means that the very young foal isn't really able to benefit from vaccination. So we will vaccinate mares for rotavirus, and then the antibodies, which are produce the, an antibody is the, essentially the tool that the immune system uses to fight off infection. They get passed to the foal, the young foal, via the mare's milk. So it's really important that baby foals have colostrum. That's where they get their immunity from. And colostrum is the first milk that is produced over the first few hours after foaling. And there's a test actually that you can do. We generally do it at about 18 plus hours of life to check whether the foal has actually gained adequate colostrum. And there are various things that can be done if it hasn't. But if you are having a new foal, then it's really good to have a day one check, and your vet would usually include a test there to assess its immune system. But typically foals will start their vaccination programs at about 6 months of age, and that's where they're going to get the influenza, tetanus. And so because they can't be vaccinated for tetanus when they're very young, quite a lot of vets will recommend that they're given antitoxin. The other things that perhaps people may not be aware of for vaccines for foals, but worth thinking about, are Lawsonia vaccines. So Lawsonia is a disease very specific in the young horse. It actually affects young pigs and can be affect quite a wide range of species, so deer, rodents, those sort of things, birds, in fact, pheasants, that sort of species. So foals are exposed to Lawsonia in the kind of 6 to 13 months of age group. So a lot of farms nowadays will fit in Lawsonia vaccines, which are they're not licensed for the use in horses. So we actually tend to use a pig product. But if you do have young foals, it would definitely be worth talking to your own vet about the merits of using those particular products, given that they aren't licensed for the use in the horse. There are some significant benefits, but probably not enough time here to discuss all the pros and cons of using unlicensed products. But certainly if you're having a foal, you should review the whole program from birth, getting its immunity checked, and then perhaps adding in those extra vaccines that are required for the foal, which one might be less familiar with if you're used to dealing with adult horses. But I have a question for Richard, actually, about the West Nile vaccine. Which horses do you think should get West Nile vaccine today, if you like?
I think today is probably a good time to do it. We're not particularly seeing West Nile in, because of the sort of climate change. We're certainly not, I think, at risk currently. It does tend to be a seasonal disease. But I think those people that are planning on travelling their horses for competition or breeding, more for competition, and we know that goes on, travelling to the warmer southern climes of Europe.
Yeah, so you mean travelling internationally?
Travelling internationally and understanding what the disease risks are in the area that they're going to. And that information can be sought through a range of different platforms, and we try and alert people through our platforms when disease is going on. You can look historically at times of the year when diseases are happening. And I would just note to people that whilst we say we haven't got West Nile, we haven't got it circulating and causing disease in the same way that they see it in other parts of Europe and North America. But we have had the odd case be diagnosed, and we had one of those in 2022, and it was a horse that travelled back from southern Spain. It was out there for several weeks. It would clearly have been exposed to the virus, certainly through biting mosquitoes, and it started to develop neurological signs at the time it was travelling back to the UK. It did go into an equine hospital and was diagnosed by an expert who had seen the case when they were working in North America, and they were able to diagnose it and knew what they were dealing with. So, you know, it is something that should be on the radar. And so, yeah, I think it's horses traveling to parts of the world where the disease will be considered endemic, i.e. reoccurs every year, and therefore those animals will be at risk, and they can be prevented by vaccinating. And the vaccine is available in the UK, but just the owners, vets will need to seek it out, may need to, you know, do a bit of planning to get hold of it, but it can be accessed and used.
But just to kind of re-emphasize the point, horses are not traveling internationally. Probably really isn't a benefit in adding West Nile vaccine to their regime.
No,
would you agree with that?
I would. Not at this stage. I don't think UK-based horses who are not traveling are at no greater risk at the present time. Obviously, we are looking out for... any, you know, sometimes you reach that tipping point where suddenly there is a disease, you know, disease in a different species, blue tongue virus. We didn't have that in Northern Europe until quite recently. And now the UK has got it. So suddenly the situation can change quite dramatically. And that's what we're here to help people with. And we will certainly publicise that if that situation changes.
Yeah, and I think it's probably one of those, it's key to work with your vet on this, you know, but what's best for you, as you said, both said, for your individual horse, your individual set of circumstances. Now, one of the things that we did touch on there was the idea of booster vaccines. And obviously there are rules around this about, you know, the gaps you should leave and how, you know, how regularly those should be done. Why is it so important that a booster vaccine is done within that recommended time frame?
Okay. I think it's important to note that before vaccines come onto the market and are made available to a wide, you know, to a large number of animals, they have to go through some very rigorous testing to demonstrate that they are efficacious, they do the job, they prevent the disease, and that their dosing regime is appropriate for that. And yes, the people may get a bit confused that different vaccines have different dosing regimes, but that's because the work that's had to be done has demonstrated that what's on the data sheet, what's on the label, if you like, is what's most effective for that product. Sometimes we find with experience in the field that actually we have to do it more frequently in order to even optimize what was originally found. And that's the case with influenza. But generally speaking, by following what the label says, we should be optimizing the immunity across the population that are receiving it, and we'll get the best results. And so that's why, generally speaking, you know, vets putting these in and advising their clients should be following what's on the what we call the data sheet, but also keeping an eye on what expert opinion might be saying in terms of, and a lot of that is evidence that's coming from the field to say, well, you know, we're getting failure of vaccine where an animal may have only been boosted nearly 12 months ago. That's quite a long time in terms of having a last booster for something like influenza, which is evolving and trying to evade the immune system of the horse.
And of course, very important to keep an eye on the competition regulations as well around vaccines, particularly, you know, so if you're going out doing competition and things. A lot of the time those competitions have rules about how frequently those vaccines must take place.
Yes, they do. And they've been changing over the time. We have, you know, we try and advise the different groups to align what they're saying so that there is consistency. And also not to rush in and do, you know, people have to be warned that these changes are coming, and therefore there is a period for people to get the news of when it is changing. But it is, you know, we are sympathetic. It is a little bit fraught with differences between disciplines, and I'm sure Celia's got a thought on that, because it's tasks to,
yeah, tasks. I think I definitely do have thoughts. It's the intervals between, it's not really boosters, but the primary course, the first, second and third vaccines that are given for flu, we're increasingly seeing that the various different sports are sort of harmonizing towards a more unified standard approach. And I think some regulations have come out from a range of different sports as of January 1st, and a number of them have really followed the lead of the FEI. So the FEI and the racing authorities have largely come into alignment over the first three vaccines. And I think actually it is confusing if there are all these different sports. But one thing that's probably worth saying is, of course, that if you follow the manufacturer's recommendations, guess what? That will fit with the pretty much, I believe, Richard, every sport. I'm right about that. If you follow the manufacturer's recommendations, what it will mean is you're not taking advantage of the advantage isn't the right word. You're not utilizing some of the more extended periods that some sporting organizations still allow. But it's important to understand, just because they allow you some leeway, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing to use it. So if you follow the manufacturer's recommendations for the first three vaccines, you're never going to go wrong with any sport. And then where the differences do start to become more apparent is whether or not you're required to have a vaccine within 6 months of competition, which is the FEI rule, or you're required to do it every 6 months, which is the racing sort of rule, versus perhaps some of the other sports where mixing is not quite so intense, the Pony Club, for example, then they are fitting with manufacturers' recommendations and saying do it once a year. Now, why would the FEI say within 6 months and racing say every 6 months? Well, you've got to remember the age difference in the horses competing in those sports. So in racing, the horses are relatively young. They go through their racing career. They're having these 6 monthly vaccines, whereas horses in FEI sports have probably had a much longer sort of background. And so it's quite a practical approach that the FEI has adopted, I think, because it does mean that for sports that are somewhat seasonal in nature, you can actually time your vaccines at that time of year so that, such that they still only have one vaccine per year. It just happens to be given near to the competition season, which of course is usually the summer. For some of the other sports, show jumping, dressage, for example, that go on throughout the year, that within 6 months requirement might mean that they have to have two in any given year. So I know that people do find it confusing that different organisations have different rules. One of the groups that both Richard and I are involved in is an advisory group for British Equestrian, and we're working with all the member bodies to try and get them sort of aligning and being more harmonised, and I think the direction of travel really is that pretty soon, hopefully, we'll just really have the FEI rules and can follow those, and that will make it simpler for owners, and it will make it simpler for vets too. But fundamentally, particularly if you're involved in one of the smaller sports, you should check the regulations, but be aware that just because your sporting body might allow you to have some more flexibility, you should definitely not read that as my sporting body is requiring me or encouraging me to go outside of the manufacturer's recommendations. You can never go wrong if you follow the vaccine manufacturer's recommendations, at least with the basic course. Would you agree with that, Richard?
I would, wholeheartedly. Yeah. It's that wriggle room and how much you're allowed that causes the problems very often.
It is important that if you're going to a competition, you can't expect the horse to be vaccinated the day before. So as a rough rule of thumb, most of them require a week. And that's for two reasons. One is the horse, you know, sometimes just as when we have vaccinations for COVID or flu or whatever we have, you know, maybe you are a little bit flat for the next 48 hours, but much more important reason is that you've got to give the vaccine some time to work. So the response is not instantaneously. Actually, even a week, the vaccine may not have produced its full impact on the immune system. That probably takes a little bit longer, but you do have to have that window between vaccination and actually going to the competition.
I think we've very thoroughly covered vaccination there, which is brilliant. What are some of the other steps that horse owners can take to protect their horses from disease, and particularly in instances where horses might be mingling?
Yeah, well, if I can take this one. The first thing is to reflect on what I said earlier. Risk is not a binary option. It's not a there's no risk or there's lots of risk. It's a kind of a sliding scale. And what we want, what we're trying to do with any measure that we take, is take that risk and reduce it as low as we can. And we can do that in multiple ways. Generally, the more effort you put into reducing risk, the lower the risk will be. But I think the probably just reflecting on my experience of working with horses and horse owners is that assuming we've covered off vaccination, is to think about your ability to quarantine horses. So a lot of properties in designing how they're going to use their stables, they forget about having an area which is just a bit separate into which they can put new horses coming to the yard, or horses that may have been away and mixing and are now coming home. So what is an optimal quarantine? Well, again, there's no real black and white answer to that question. Basically, when in terms of distance, the greater the distance, the more impactful it'll be. And now, clearly, not everybody can have a special quarantine isolated unit in the way that, for example, a hospital might have. But on large equestrian properties, it certainly is sensible for them to have a separate small block in which they keep empty, that they can introduce new horses via that route. And in a regular just livery yard, perhaps having a field shelter or some sort of outdoor area where you can separate horses, new horses coming into the property, is really important. Then the next question about quarantines is, well, how long are you going to quarantine the horse for? Well, from a veterinary perspective, my answer would have to be 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks. And keeping a horse separate, monitoring its temperature regularly, making sure that in those first 2 weeks there's no fevers, there's no clinical signs, seeking veterinary attention if there are any clinical signs, is probably the most important and impactful thing that you can do. I think it is useful also to have a plan. If you're in a mixed livery yard situation where there's perhaps multiple owners and lots of people involved, actually putting a plan in place and getting everybody to sign up to it, so that you don't have to be making decisions on the hoof when it's really challenging. It's really difficult, actually, in a kind of panic situation. Say a new horse has arrived and all of a sudden it's got a fever, it's got nasal discharge. You've put it right in the middle of all the other horses. The attention level is going to be high. So if you have a kind of agreed plan, you can almost take that off your shelf and say, look, we decided this is what we're going to do, guys. Let's all do it. Means that these plans can be implemented far more efficiently and far more effectively.
I agree with everything Celia said there. And if I was to boil it all down to 4 words, which is probably not always sensible, but there's something called the 4 8s that we talk about, and that's vaccinate for obvious reasons, isolate, which deals with that idea of keeping animals separate, particularly if they are showing signs of disease, investigate, which is calling in the vet, know what you're dealing with, get a diagnosis, and then the sort of last one is communicate, and that might be that you're communicating a plan, you're letting people know that you've got a disease, that you've got it under control, etc., and looking to deal with it that way. So vaccinate, isolate, investigate, communicate. And I think if people can adopt those when they're thinking about prevention, and then action if they are unfortunate to have a condition, then hopefully then they working with their vet will be able to deal with it highly effectively.
I like that. That's nice and easy to remember. I have to keep that in mind. Now, probably the last thing we want to touch on today, and it is something that's been a bit of a theme actually through our conversation, is these exotic diseases. How much of a serious and I guess an imminent threat are they for our UK horse population?
I think, as we touched on before, and we've talked about West Nile, I think it's very hard to judge about how imminent something is. But I think when you're thinking about imminence, you have to look at what's happening and is it creeping closer to you. Unfortunately, we know from examples in other species, and I go back to 2006 when a disease called blue tongue virus A suddenly appeared in the Netherlands. You can't necessarily predict when these things will happen and then what the consequences are. So we have to really keep a very broad view, look at the horizon. So do some horizon. What is happening elsewhere in the world? What might suddenly happen? And, you know, it isn't just things that we know are happening in horses necessarily. We have to think about the potential for cross-species transmission. Some of, you know, influenza viruses, you know, conventionally are diseases of birds, and then they transmit over into new species, and we see that, and that's actually something that we need to keep an eye on. Could the next horse flu virus actually not be a horse flu virus currently, but it translates across into horses? And we've seen dogs getting infected with flu, we've seen pigs transfer between into humans and other animals such as cats and dogs, as I've said. So, you know, we are looking both close and far. And in terms of close, I think West Nile is probably the one. We know that this condition, equine infectious anemia, and that's important because if animals are found to be harbouring that virus, by law, at the moment, they are obliged to be put to sleep. It's that serious a condition. So thinking about that animal that you're bringing in from abroad, have you tested it for these conditions? And if it does come here, is it going to pose a risk to our sort of national disease status? So I've probably, again, set the alarm bells ringing a little bit, but we can't ignore these things. We have to be aware that they are out there. But yeah, imminent is a, I don't know, it's a difficult thing to quantify, I think.
Yeah, I think if you ask me that question, you get a slightly different answer, and again it reflects the differences in our background, but I would really highlight small redworm actually, and I know that actually you're going to have a whole session on worming during Equine Health Week, which is great, so I'll just kind of plug it as a go elsewhere for more information, but we are seeing more and more problems with small redworm, and that there are a variety of reasons for that. One really important one is the fact that the worming products that we have available to us, the parasites are increasingly being resistant to that, and that's it becomes a bit more speculative, but as the weather gets milder, we don't have the hard frost perhaps that we once did, that may well be contributing to it. So it's present and it's increasing. If that's not quite emerging, it's emerged, but it's becoming a more and more important threat.
Brilliant. Well, this has been a really interesting session. Hopefully everyone listening has learned something, taken it away, even if it is just to check your horse's passport and check when your next vaccine is due. Obviously, last time we ran Equine Health Week, the focus was very much on these infectious diseases. So if you want to find out more about any of the diseases we've talked about today, there are plenty of resources on the British Equestrian website, loads and loads of talks. Celia and Richard were both involved in that, as was the advisory group they mentioned, so make sure you check that out, get yourself clued up, and there's loads of really great resources on there. Thank you very much everyone for listening today. We hope you've enjoyed the session. Make sure that if you've missed any of the podcasts up till now, you check back to wherever you found this one, and listen up, and we've got plenty more really interesting stuff coming for the rest of the week.